I'm Victor the Voice Furman.
And I'm the Romance Reverend Lori Sue Brockway.
And we are Love and Romance Radio. Our guests tonight are Dr. Ellen Keller. Oh, boy. There we go. Right off the bat.
Okay.
Sorry, folks.
You're not the first one to
I know.
Say that.
Our guests tonight are Dr. Ellen Kenner and Dr. Edwin A. Locke, co-authors of The Selfish Path to Romance, How to Love with Passion and Reason. It's inspired by the ideas of Ayn Rand. Dr. Kenner is a licensed clinical psychologist with a private practice in Rhode Island and host of the nationally syndicated radio talk show, The Rational Basis of Happiness. Her specialty is exploring how to apply the rational, pro-happiness philosophy of Ayn Rand's objectivism to mental health issues. Dr. Kenner earned her PhD from the University of Rhode Island and her BA from Brown University. Dr. Locke is an internationally known and widely published scholar in the field of industrial organizational psychology, with 15 years of clinical experience and more than three decades as a professor of psychology and management at the University of Maryland. He's written more than 280 books, chapters, and articles, and is widely cited in psychological literature. He's also a scholar and advocate of the works of Ayn Rand, and has written and spoken extensively about her philosophy, and has been a senior writer for the Ayn Rand Institute. His numerous contributions include his lecture on romantic love in the novels of Ayn Rand. He's a fellow of the American Psychological Association and of the American Psychological Society, and frequently speaks at conferences on the topic of setting goals for life and happiness. He earned his PhD from Cornell University, his BA from Harvard, and he lives in California. Please welcome Dr. Kenner and Dr. Locke. Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Thank you.
We're so glad that you're here, and we're so curious about your work and your book. And let's just set the stage for our listeners. Let's start with a little overview of Ms. Rand's work and philosophy of objectivism. And can you just give us an overview of who she was and what she did and what she believed in?
Ed, would you like to do that?
Okay. Well, she was a novelist, and she became a philosopher so she could write novels because she needed a code of values that she wanted to project. So in 1 minute, her philosophy was reality is real. Second, man's only means of knowing reality is sense perception and reason, which integrates sensory material. In the realm of ethics, she had a theory of reason as the highest virtue, and with other virtues like integrity and honesty as expressions of that, and believed the purpose of morality was to make you have a successful and happy life. So obviously that includes egoism, because each person she viewed as an end in themselves. In politics, she believed in capitalism, and she also had a very original theory of art and its psychological function in man's life.
Wow.
So,
go ahead.
So, Ellen, you want to add on?
Well, we have in the introduction of the book you mentioned, our book, The Selfish Path to Romance, that she was born in St. Petersburg, Russia on February 2nd, 1905. And she heard the shots of the first revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution, in 1917. And she went to the University of Petrograd in 1924. She graduated then. And basically, she wanted a philosophy for living on Earth, really enjoying your life, as Ed said. And so I know her books have changed countless people's lives, including my own. I mean, I say Ayn Rand changed my life. Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged changed my life. I loved her books.
Mm-hmm. And she would have been shot had she stayed in Russia. She was very fortunate to get out. She had some relatives in Chicago that somehow helped her during the period when the communists let people leave, which would come and go. They never let her parents or sisters leave. So she was extremely fortunate to get out before it was too late. All her relatives died in Russia.
Mm.
And if I take this, if I take her work correctly, there is really no place for religion, faith, or the unseen. This is direct reason through observation. Is that correct?
Correct. Observation and reason applied to observation.
I see. Now tell us a little about the huge impact she's had, about the kinds of movements that she spawned, and the type of people who follow her.
Well, if people start by being attracted to one or more of her novels, she wrote four novels, including one which is kind of a novelette, and then scores of nonfiction works. Her books, such as Atlas Shrugs, have sold millions and millions of copies and continue to sell millions of copies. But objectivism is not a political movement right now. We think it's way, way too early for that. So really the goal of objectivists is to simply educate people in the philosophy.
Well, and I can add something. When I went to Brown University, and I was really trying to feel grounded, and I didn't feel grounded at Brown. I felt like I always owed my life to somebody else or something else, and I always felt like I was carrying around a ton of guilt, and I never could quite put my hand on what that guilt was about. It was elusive. And when I first heard her on Donahue, Ayn Rand on Donahue, and then I read her book, The Fountainhead, and then Atlas Shrugged. And when I read Atlas Shrugged, I experienced her as having cut through years of hypocrisy and gave me the grounding I had been looking for. And that was that I had been carrying around a lot of unearned guilt. And that's different from earned guilt. If I lie to someone, I earn the guilt. If I steal, I earn the guilt. But if I have done nothing wrong and I'm just a good student or a good person and I'm feeling guilty, I really need to question, is this guilt is this guilt based on facts, or am I just living a life of self-sacrifice needlessly? And it was wonderful to read her works because I felt like I was liberated from this always needing to feel in hock to other people. And the alternative... Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, the alternative was not me being mean to others. I never wanted to be mean to people. And I had seen people, even in my family, who were kind of manipulative or conniving, and I never wanted to be like that. And yet I didn't want people to step on me either, and I didn't know how to find myself. And what objectivism gave me, or Ayn Rand, especially through Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead, was feeling like that was a false alternative. It isn't that you're a mean person or that you're a selfless doormat in life. The alternative is that you're a self-respecting person of good character and that you hope everybody else gives themselves that same gift, and then you form very good friendships with those people. So it's a win-win rather than a win-lose.
That makes a lot... I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, we have like a six-second delay like CNN.
Yeah, no,
sorry about
ahead.
That. You make a really excellent point, and it seems like a lack of self-esteem is one of the epidemics of our time. And when you mention the word unearned guilt, are there other things like that that come along with, people who take on, take on the family karma or, in family therapy, there's always a presenting patient who seems crazy because everyone else in the family is insane or doing something, really inappropriate, but there's the one person who kind of carries it all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, the main cause of unearned guilt is altruism, which the real definition of altruism is otherism. So you live solely for other people and never for yourself. To the degree that people accept that, it's a lose-lose situation because it doesn't matter how much you do, it's never enough because your life doesn't belong to you. So there's, of course, earned guilt, such as criminals, liars, robbers, murderers. But most guilt, we think, is caused by altruism. And it's kind of a package deal because people see altruism as combined with benevolent consideration for others. And it's a package, but it's actually totally different. Benevolence toward others comes from goodwill in a situation where other people are not your enemy. And then they've package deal egoism to mean what we mean, which is using your mind and treating people fairly and justly with criminality. So both package deals are devastating for people, and Ayn Rand has unpacked those packages and showed how you can be selfish by using the rational faculty, pursuing rational values, having virtue without hurting others by trading with others spiritually or monetarily, and condemns, like everyone else, all forms of criminality.
But does that leave room for compassion? Is there room for compassion?
Ellen?
It depends what how you define compassion. If you define compassion by having empathy for somebody who's in trouble through no fault of their own, you know, a tornado hit their home, or they were shot by somebody and they didn't do anything wrong, or you want to help out a family who just recently came to America and they're really struggling and you like them, you know, you can definitely feel compassion toward those. But if compassion means selflessness, that you have to morally sacrifice yourself to feel good and always have to give to other people, then no, absolutely not. That's a recipe for people who have that type of compassion. You see it in churches a lot and temples, where it becomes phony. Oh, how are you, dearie? Oh, yeah, I feel so badly for you. And they don't really feel badly for you. You know, it's just they put on an act. And it's that false compassion that I'm so much against. I'm sure Ed is. And that we want to differentiate that from genuine compassion.
And this is especially damaging, to get back to our book, especially damaging in romance, because if you practice altruism consistently and enthusiastically, you end up having no self. And the altruist will usually attract the narcissist, because the narcissist sees a good deal when he finds it.
My husband's shaking his head.
here's a person who will serve me selflessly and do whatever I want, and I'm the master. So it's a kind of a magnetic attraction. If you don't have a self, you can't. What's going to happen in romance is you're going to end up extremely depressed and probably taken advantage of and maybe even abused, because you have nothing that you're seeking or striving for, nothing that you're wanting, nothing that you're pushing for. And it becomes a one-way kind of situation. So it's a disaster to be an altruist in romance. Our view of romance is it's mutual egoism, whose goal is both people work very hard to help the other person get what they want.
I think I need to pull out my old copy of Atlas Shrugged and read it again.
So let's take a simple example. Okay, he wants to go to a shoot 'em up movie. She wants to go to a romantic movie. Okay, so both of them want sacrifice. Both of them really don't like the other kind of movies. So how could you work that out? Well, there's lots of ways if you're creative. The guy can go with another guy and have his kicks. For that, she can go with her girlfriend. They can also look for movies that have some kind of a reasonable mixture, but not too much of violence and romance. They can get videos at home and each watch what they want. And this The same applies to sex. Both of them work to figure out how we can give each other pleasure. The other person is a tremendous selfish value. That's what, in our opinion, love is. So you love giving your partner pleasure because they're a personal, special value to you. And so it's not a sacrifice to give them pleasure. It's a pleasure to give them pleasure, and vice versa.
Have you guys been spying on our relationship?
Well, the good news is I've had so many clients when they've read our book, they've said, oh, my God, it sounds just like me. And the good news is that so many people suffer from buying into altruism because they think that that's what's moral. And so they sacrifice and they set up these relationships that are just so painful. The person they initially loved suddenly becomes their enemy, their husband or wife or partner. And how do you turn that around? Well, that's why Ed and I wrote the book. You can turn that around. You can find the principles behind any good relationship. You know, what makes it good? How do you make yourself lovable? We talk about that. How do you find the right partner? How do you work together and communicate well and resolve conflict? And how do you enjoy sex? No, we have it all.
Another consequence of altruism is that you don't have to earn love because it's your due.
Mm-hmm.
The person owes it to you as a duty, and that's a disaster too. So we think love has to be earned by making yourself into a good person and acting accordingly.
And also in terms of sex, I mean, people are taught from the church or even in a secular environment that sex is somehow dirty and disgusting because it brings you pleasure. You know, it's a guilty pleasure. And so people have very mixed feelings about that because we're told that it's very dirty and yet we're supposed to save it for the person we love. You know, so it's
dirty or duty.
And then it's a duty, too. You have to serve your partner. So it goes on many women's, typically women's, to-do list. You know, I got to make them happy. I got to cook. I got to do the laundry. I'm going to work. And then we have to have sex and get it off the to-do list for another week or so. And that's tragic and that's very common. But women often don't give, and men too, but more often women, don't give themselves a voice on what they enjoy. What feels good, what doesn't feel good. They self-limit, and then they leave their partner to try to read their mind, and then the partner just throws up the hand and says, okay. And, you know, their romantic life goes down the tubes gradually.
Well, do you think this is one of the reasons that romance books are so popular and why a book like 50 Shades of Grey, even, which was not, which didn't seem on the surface to be about a love story, but if you read the second and third book, there really was a love story there. Do you think that's why these kind of books really captivate women readers so strongly? Because.
Well, women are the biggest readers of romance books, as you know.
Yep.
And I think because women tend to be more in touch with their emotions. And also, they have a greater understanding than a lot of men that sex isn't usually a primary in romantic love. It's an expression of an emotional bond, an emotional visibility. And if you don't have that, then sex doesn't work very well.
Right.
Because sex is pleasurable, but it's not just physical, it's an expression of a wider spiritual connection. And if you try to divorce it from that, it becomes very mechanical and after a while doesn't have a lot of meaning. So we believe a lot of sex problems are emotional attachment problems. And sex is simply a symptom of that. I mean, you can have sex problems too due to lack of communication. But an awful lot of it, you don't have that connection emotionally, and so you're not motivated for intimacy.
Gotcha. Yep, that makes a lot of sense. And let's, you know, you guys, you were speakers at objectivist conferences over the years, And you collaborated on a workshop on romance and family issues. I think it was called Romance, Bringing Love and Sex Together,
yeah.
That you worked on. I don't know how many times you taught it, but I was wondering if that was the genesis of your book, your new book, Selfish Path to Love, of love.
That wasn't.
Ellen, go ahead.
Well, that wasn't quite the genesis. That was that happened, I think, after we had written the book, Ed.
Oh, I thought it was before.
Ed,
your memory's better than mine.
Ed approached me. I had given courses. First, Ed and I go way back. I was new to objectivism. Objectivism is the philosophy of Ayn Rand. It's a very pro-reason, pro-happiness, pro-win-win in terms of relationships philosophy. And I loved her books, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I went to my very first conferences that occurred after she had passed away and went to Ed's classes. And loved Ed's classes to the point where I took a picture of Ed, and when I went back to the university to get my doctorate, I had Ed's picture on my wall at my home right outside my kitchen as inspiration because I loved his ideas. He did two wonderful courses on happiness, finding happiness in your life, and those were just so enormous in terms of my growth that I felt very, very much in admiration of you, Ed. And then I fast forward a bit, and then I started teaching at Objectivist conferences after I got my doctorate. And Ed came to one or two of my classes, and you approached me afterwards, Ed, and said, "Would you like to write a book on romance?" And that's how we took off from there. So
we were going to ask you how that collaboration came about, because, I mean, isn't it so interesting that you both would have, you know, come from similar backgrounds and have such an interest in this philosophy and have a way to turn it into something of use to singles and couples today?
I don't know if they came from similar backgrounds philosophically. I was brought up in the church, Episcopal,
mm-hmm.
and my mother made me go to all the stuff, and I decided when I was in college that I didn't agree with it. So, Ellen, I don't know if your background was similar.
I was brought up by a family. My family was Jewish but not practicing, and they didn't believe in any God. But my neighborhood, oh, my God, it was Roman Catholic, and everybody believed in God, and everything was a sin. And I really had to question at a very young age, was there a God? Does it make any sense? And so I had to do a lot of questioning on my own. And for me, you know, not just following my parents' footsteps. And then when I heard Ayn Rand on Donahue and read The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, the gift that I got from her was not a packaged philosophy. The key gift was learning how to think for myself much more clearly, how to ask questions in an essentialized way, and really gaining self-esteem by learning how to use my mind better. And building character traits so that I enjoy my life, you live with yourself for your whole life. We're talking about partnering, but the first person you live with is yourself, so you want to make yourself into a person that you enjoy being with.
Well, you both escaped from the possibility of the base guilt that's engendered in Judaism, Episcopalianism, and Catholicism. So in essence, you do have something in common. You were able to transcend that basic guilt.
Well, it's interesting. I didn't go through the suffering of Ellen and always feeling guilty. My mother pulled that on me, and I simply wouldn't buy it. But I didn't have a philosophy. And when I took philosophy courses, I thought philosophy was the most stupid, ridiculous piece of nonsense I'd ever heard in my life. I thought it had nothing to do with the real world or how to live your life. So what Ayn Rand gave me was an actual philosophy to live by. I was a good person, but I was a non-religious person. I didn't have any philosophy. So what she gave me was a philosophy that was integrated and was applying to life on earth. And so that's how I came to it. But I personally didn't suffer from unearned guilt.
But it makes me wonder if unearned guilt is more of a female malady in our culture, and not to gender stereotype, but women really carry a lot of that. I mean, I hear that story a lot from people. Even, you know, we're both wedding officiants. Even when somebody's planning a wedding, there is so much pressure about making the mother happy and making the mother-in-law happy and pleasing a gazillion other people. And just in general, there's so many ways that women fall into ruts that are different than the way men fall into ruts. So I wonder if a little bit of that unearned guilt is more, is it, do you think it's more of a chick thing, Dr. Kenner?
I would absolutely say yes, although I want to give credit to many men who have had to fight and have courageously been able to fight the unearned guilt trap. But I think in our culture, it, you know, women, we were, in my generation anyway, you needed to be a superwoman. You went back to school and you raised the kids and you did everything else. I was very lucky because I had a husband who was so amazing. Oh, my God, I love my husband. And he helped out. And we really, like Ed talked about earlier, we were able to compromise, and he would take care of the kids while I would have an exam, you know, going back to school and whatnot. He was so wonderful. And we worked, we learned and we worked very well together. But I think women in general are taught to be, to have a lot of pressure on them. And it's hard when you're taught that the good girl, the good woman, the good person is a person who is doing for other people. You know, think of the do-gooders at church. And I'm not very fond of do-gooders anymore. But it's hard to untangle yourself, and I still find myself falling into the trap. And so I don't put the pressure on myself. I know that I'm a work in progress, and if I slip up and try to be a do-gooder or put myself in the shadows, I just recognize it and realize that I have an alternative and have the means to turn it around. You know, I make the change process easy. I made it very easy for, I make it easy for my clients and for myself.
Do you both?
Another factor is most people don't want to go against the status quo, such as the status quo they've been brought up in. It's very, very frightening for them to reject certain things about they were told when they were growing up. So one thing about objectivism, you really have to make independent judgment. And if you're frightened of that, it's not going to be a philosophy you can adopt.
Do you subscribe to the axiom, no good deed shall go unpunished?
Well, I'm not quite sure how to interpret that.
The idea being is that those who go out and go above and beyond for others in an altruistic way generally end up having some type of negative response from it.
Yeah, they get very resentful.
They get resentful, and it's also, it's never enough.
Yeah. Right. That's the key. It's never enough, and you can never feel like you're doing enough. And if you're someone who strives for some sort of excellence and caregiving, you're never going to feel like you've really nailed it.
Is altruism an addiction?
No, I
think people in our society, maybe other societies, treat it as an axiom. By axiom, I mean a starting point that can't be questioned. I think that's the way people hold it. And they also hold egoism as an evil axiom because they identify it with criminality. So to... And having people question something that fundamental is also mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's very difficult.
To people, mind-boggling.
It's always a choice, and I think it's the one of the fundamental struggles that every one of us goes through. But altruism becomes a habit of mind, but it's not an addiction in the sense that you have no choice. It's like just something that happens, and you're drugged on it. I mean, that's a good analogy to use, but it, in fact, people always question when they become resentful, why do I do for everyone else? I do for my kids, I do for my in-laws, and nobody ever thinks of me. Nobody does for me. Of course, you don't let them do for you. That's one of the problems. So, you know, it becomes a habit of mind, and over time people become resentful and bitter, and or they become very depressed, which is very sad to see too, any of the consequences of having a non-traitor relationship.
Think, Ellen, in your practice, didn't you see that in middle-aged women quite often?
Oh, very, very much. I saw that a lot. You know, finally, it's my time. I'm going to do what I want. And I'd say, well, what are some of the things that you've dreamt about? What did you want to do? And they said, I never gave myself permission to think about what I want. And that, you know, that's really sad that they feel like they're floating. They don't have any foothold because they wouldn't let themselves be, the word that we use in the book, selfish. And even the title of our book, Ed and I thought long and hard about that, although we both loved the title, because in the our title for listeners is The Selfish Path to Romance, How to Love with Passion and Reason. And in the first chapter, and it is free, by the way, anyone can go to Amazon.com or drkenner.com or selfishromance.com. And read it. But, you know, when we chose the word The Selfish Path to Romance, we really wanted people to get the fact that it's great to value yourself. It's great to have self-esteem, to learn how to self-nurture, to build good character. And you want that for both partners. It's not just my way or the highway. However, I will say that when my parents first heard the title of our book, you can imagine how their eyes rolled.
Oy vey.
It's because it sounds like we're writing the book The Mean Rotten Way to Romance, you know, how to be a my way or the highway person. And it's absolutely not that. It's how to value yourself and cherish your partner, both. It's a win-win situation.
And on that note, I'm going to say you're listening to Love and Romance Radio on the DTM Wicked Radio Network, and we'll be back momentarily with our fascinating guests, Dr. Ellen Kenner and Dr. Edwin A. Locke. We'll be right back.
The Kane Coaching Center is a proud sponsor of DTM Wicked Radio Network. What would it mean to you to have better health, more energy, more vitality, and an all-around better life? At the Caring Coaching Center, our mission is to be your partner in helping you reach your health, fitness, and lifestyle goals. We do this through a dynamic 6-month program that helps our clients reach their goals and their full potential. And it all starts with a free, no obligation, 50-minute health history consultation. Just visit us at the www.thecaringcoachingcenter.com to schedule your free consultation today. Or you can go to www.dtmwickedradio.com, click the sponsor page, scroll down to the Caring Coaching Center tab, click on the tab and open up to the website to start your free consultation today. It's all here on dtmwickedradio.com.
Rolling Hills Asylum. Located in East Bethany, New York, just minutes between two major airports, Rolling Hills Asylum is a hotbed of paranormal activity. They have been featured on Travel Channel's Ghost Adventures, Paranormal Challenge, as well as Sci-Fi Channel's Ghost Hunters. Rolling Hills Asylum has been named the number 2 most haunted location in the United States by HauntedNorthAmerica.com. The property was established on January 1st, 1827, as the county poor farm. Throughout the years, it has operated as a poor farm, infirmary, orphanage, tuberculosis hospital, nursing home, and more. Past residents and inmates consist of widows, orphans, physically disabled, mentally unstable, murderers, and more. Over 1,700 bodies are buried in unmarked graves, and hundreds more deaths went undocumented. Rolling Hills Asylum is known for a plethora of phenomena, including disembodied voices, doors slamming, footsteps, sounds of furniture moving, full-body apparitions, shadow people, ghostly touches, and numerous Class A EVP. Rolling Hills Asylum proudly offers historical and flashlight tours, 4- and 8-hour public ghost hunts, 8- and 9-hour private ghost hunts, and more, by appointment or pre-booking only. For more information, please visit www.rollinghillsasylum.com. That's www.rollinghillsasylum.com. Or give them a call, 585 585- 585-502-4066. That's 585-502-4066. Rolling Hills Asylum, what are you doing this weekend?
And we're back on Love and Romance Radio with our guests, Dr. Ellen Kenner and Dr. Edwin A. Locke, co-authors of The Selfish Path to Romance, How to Love with Passion and Reason, inspired by the ideas of Ayn Rand. Laura Sue?
Well, is there any particular, can you share just a little bit more on her take on self-esteem? You know, sort of a just the shorter version of that, why it's so important?
Well, you have to feel that you have value in order to function and act in the world and pursue values. If you feel you're worthless for whatever reason, you're complete. Not only are you depressed, but you're unmotivated to take any kind of sustained action. Now, Ayn Rand's theory of self-esteem was not based on approval. It was based on the consistent use of your mind. So you could say it's based on consistent thinking for yourself as the most important aspect of self-esteem. So it's a very different theory of self-esteem than psychologists typically talk about.
Okay.
Right. And she's got a wonderful quote from The Fountainhead, one of her novels. To say I love you, one must first know how to say the I. Because if there's no you there, if you feel like a doormat and someone says, I love you, but you don't love yourself, you're never going to believe them.
What was Ayn Rand's own romantic life like?
She was married to the same man for, like, I don't know, 50 years. She really, really loved him. He wasn't super intellectual, but he was a former actor. He was a very... very good person. There was some temporary problems in their personal life, but I think they were really devoted to each other until he died, and she didn't live too long afterwards.
Soulmates, maybe? Or is that not rational?
Yeah, I think soulmates is a good description of it.
That's great. That's great. Could you guys define romantic love for us? Like, in your book, how are you defining it?
Go ahead, Ellen.
I'll give you our definition. Romantic love is a strong, emotionally intimate relationship between consenting adults that combines an intense valuing of a partner on the deepest level and the enjoyment of sexual pleasure with that partner.
That's
so it's really Ed and I in one of our classes asked people what's the essence of romantic love, and they were guessing, they were coming up with things, and what Ed and I both agree on is emotional intimacy. You feel that person cares for you, they get you on the deepest level, they know who you are, you feel at home with them, you feel cherished, you feel important, you feel loved. And that's for mutual, it's for both partners.
Beautiful.
And it's hard to create.
But from your definition, this type of relationship is not easy. This takes work.
You're absolutely right. And again, I'm going to give you a little history. Ellen hit the jackpot and is still married to the same guy after, what, 35 years?
40 plus.
Now, it took me 3 tries to get it right. I'm extremely happy now. I've been married for 15 years. But I didn't know anything about love when I started. I knew nothing about love other than, you know, what a person on the street knows. So it took me, although my ex was a very, very good person. It wasn't a good match emotionally, but she remarried happily and I remarried happily. So it took a while to figure out who you are and the kind of thing that's going to work. You know, people get so entranced sometimes by looks, and it's not that looks don't matter, But to be trite, looks are skin deep. And if that's all the relationship is based on, and mine wasn't, it was based on more, but there's so many factors in romantic love that you have to understand and you have to feel at home with each other on. Moral values, tastes, education, interest, how you deal with money, earning a living, how to handle disagreements, lifestyle, personality style, emotional connection, visibility. To figure this out, you got to do a lot of thinking.
Yeah, no, I agree with that fully, and I feel like my husband and I had the wonderful advantage of growing together. We married fairly young, and we just learned from each other. I would read a lot of psychology self-help books or take classes, and anytime I learned that I was very open to changing myself, improving myself, because I knew something was off base, and we would both learn communication skills together. And we would both, you know, we would both catch each other, but very gently. My husband would say, oh, my gosh, with parenting, Ellen, you need to teach the parenting course again. You're losing the skills. And I would hear that, not resentfully, but I would say, you're right. It's hard. You know, even though you can know a lot of skills, doesn't mean you can apply them in your own relationship when the problems are up close and personal, or, you know, the difficulties. And so we grew together, and I really encourage couples to grow together if they are somewhat compatible or if that potential is there.
Now, all of these skill sets are not naturally learned. These are things that people have to work on, especially the millennial generation, the digital generation that thinks communication involves text messaging each other on a constant basis. Really, the art of conversation and proximity and that type of relationship is something that's almost vanishing from our culture and our society. What do you say to young people about this?
Well, you know, it wasn't that good before, because here's the problem. People aren't taught how to communicate with another person except on a superficial level, and they're definitely not able to communicate emotionally, especially guys. And in my current marriage, I had to do a lot of work to learn emotional communication, stuff I just didn't know. Thank heaven for my wife knowing a lot of things about it. I mean, I taught her stuff, she taught me stuff, but it's, I know lots of marriages in my parents' generation, and they were often like dead marriages, like they were together, but there was nothing emotional there. There was nothing there. And stuff simply wasn't discussed. So I don't think the technology itself, I think people don't get brought up or taught to discover how to communicate, and especially not about emotions, which scares people, especially guys. Mm. Something you have to understand. Objectivism has a particular theory of emotions, which most people don't know. But our book has a lot of things on communication, and if both parties won't communicate, you have problems, including about sex, but including about other things too.
Right. And just to give you an overview of the book, and the need to, how complex it is to make a good relationship work, we've broken it down into the basics. That's part one. What is romantic love? And there we talk about you don't want to be a doormat and you don't want to be a me-only person. You want to create this wonderful win-win relationship with your partner. Part two is how do you make yourself lovable? I mean, think of living with a clone of yourself. Would you enjoy that? And if you wouldn't, what would you want to change? And how do you go about doing that? Part three is finding your soulmate, and really you need to learn what Ed's talking about, how to read your own emotions when you're with a potential partner, so that you don't just go on your gut feelings and end up with someone that's no good for you. Part four, we talk about how to make your romantic relationship thrive, how to cherish yourself and one another, and how to create a very warm climate at home. You know, you think of coming home at night to your partner, and sometimes a relationship is like coming home to a storm every night. Sometimes it's like coming home to just a gray, dull day every day. But sometimes you get a partner who's just wonderful, and it's like coming home to a sunny home. Not all the time, obviously, because even people who are happy can have really down periods. And we're just continuing with the book. Part five is enjoying sex, and part six is resolving conflict. And then we end with, and we have an appendix that, you know, what happens if it doesn't work out? And so we give in a very concise manner how to part ways and start over if you cease being soulmates. So we really cover the whole spectrum. And like you said, Victor, we give people skills. We give them the principles and the skills and really homey examples where they can say, oh, my God, I've been through that many times, so that they're very relatable examples so that they can apply the skills in their own life.
Talking about skill sets, the core virtues that you predicate your work on and Ayn Rand's entire philosophy of objectivism, rationality, honesty, integrity, independence, justice, productivity, and pride. Depending upon how your family raised you or how your family group, your culture raised you, a lot of these qualities are not something that's natural. How do you bring about a change in a person to develop these virtues?
Start young.
Great answer.
I gave my mother credit. She was religious, but not, you know, extremely religious. But she really thought honesty was important, and I respected that. And I would lie sometimes about, did I brush my teeth? But basically, I was an honest person, and I appreciated that particular virtue, and she was an honest person. So it starts young, and it's extremely difficult today because the culture is so bad in so many different ways. You know, just watch any movie or any television show. It's so full of lying and deception and, you know, meanness and cruelty and conformity that a parent has to, in a way, oppose the culture today the best way they can possibly do it, so that their kids will have a chance. But if you let your kids develop their philosophy from their peer group, you're in serious problem, serious trouble.
Dr. Kenner?
Well, I think for myself, when you talk about the core virtues, I think with honesty, I had to uproot all the little white lies. Yes, I really like your dress, and, you know, that urge to say what people want to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's not that you're cruel. I learned to reserve, to just be tactful. And if someone says, do you like this dress? I might ask them, what do you think about it? Oh, I love it. And then they don't need to know what I think about it because they love the dress, even if I didn't. But I could say, I'd say, you know, my taste is a little different from yours. You know, there are tactful ways to present things. So I needed to rout out those little white lies. I needed to learn how to really stand on my own because I, you know, parents can be very well-meaning, but and they can also think they know better than you, but they may not know better than you. You know, parents telling you, you shouldn't feel this way. You shouldn't feel bummed out. You shouldn't feel upset. You shouldn't feel angry. But I do feel angry, so I needed to be able to learn assertiveness skills without attacking, without saying, you're wrong. I do feel angry. I needed to be able to learn how to say, I am feeling angry. You wouldn't say it in that calm voice, obviously. But, you know, I am feeling angry. And that's a skill. If I said to you right now, you make me angry, you're going to feel attacked. And you're going to say, no, I don't, Ellen, you make me angry. But if I say, I'm feeling angry, what would you say to me?
Why?
Why? Mm-hmm. You inquire. So when you learn how to use I, it's called I language, assertiveness skills. You guys may know this already.
Mm-hmm.
But when you shift from you language, you make me angry, you don't know what you're talking about,
right.
You're stupid, you're this, you're that, and you, instead you just talk about yourself, that opened up a whole world to me, because then I could express those emotions in a way that where I wasn't attacking somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So in essence, you're taking responsibility for your own feelings.
Right. So I had to learn how to understand my feelings in cognitive therapy and Ayn Rand's theory of emotions, which are pretty much in sync and on many levels. But you need to know how to learn to read your emotions. For example, anger means someone did me an injustice. It's not fair. Sadness means loss of a value, something I value. I lost a boyfriend broke up with me. I lost it. I really loved him. Or I lost a good friend, or I lost my iPhone. You know, it's a loss. You need to deal with it. But that's sadness. And another emotion, happiness, is the achievement of a value. You know, I graduated from college. I'm the first, you know, people will say it's not me, but I'm the first in my family to graduate. And they feel that pride, and it's the achievement. So it's really fundamental knowledge, and I love teaching young children this too, how to read their emotions so that they're not a mystery to themselves. And so when you're talking about the objectivist virtues, backing up, I needed to learn really how to apply them in my own life. And before earlier I said that one of the gifts Ayn Rand gave me was the knowledge of how important it is to think independently, to think for myself. And Ed added that she gave an entire philosophy too. And I want to underscore that you need to understand her philosophy firsthand. And if you don't agree with it, then you don't take that part of it. If you can see how amazingly integrated it is, then you give yourself the gift with objectivism of not having to live with contradictions, chronic contradictions. You have to be good to everybody. The good person is always giving, and yet you want to do things for yourself and be that good person too, and you feel like you're always conflicted. You don't have that with Ayn Rand's philosophy. And so her philosophy is one of the best gifts that anybody could give themselves.
Is there objectivist therapy?
I think they do.
There are a handful of us out there. Yeah, not yet. You know, there are definite. Ed and I both have been therapists, and definitely my therapy is based on objectivism, and Ed's is too. But there isn't a psychological branch of objectivist therapy. It's just using reason. Cognitive therapy would come the closest to it, but when you get into their theory, oh my God, they're all over the map theoretically. But their actual practice, the skills they teach, are very good.
Yeah, you can start with, I'm okay, right?
No, you have to earn that.
Yeah. You have to be okay first.
Right, you can't feel and then say, oh, I'm okay.
Well, let's talk a little bit about passion and reason. You know, a lot of people would say that those two things don't go together. You talk about how emotions are not enough to sustain a long-term relationship. So can you share with us why it's important to combine the two?
Well, here's the secret. Emotions are experienced as primaries, and some psychologists think that way. Well, that's just the way they are. But actually, emotions are based on subconscious ideas. All emotions are based on subconscious ideas. As Ellen said, for instance, if you're angry, it means something happened to you that was unjust. And you have to understand what emotion you're having. Every emotion has a certain kind of appraisal behind it. And then what subconscious ideas you're holding, often they're incorrect. They're faulty. Like I had a patient once who felt he was a bad person for masturbating because a real man would find girls whenever he wanted. So he felt this unearned guilt. But he didn't know until I got it out of him what his wrong premise was. And of course, as soon as I fixed that, he felt a lot better. When you have passion, let's go now to romantic passion, you have to know what makes you passionate about your partner. What is it about your partner? Hopefully, it starts with the fact that they have virtues, that they're trustworthy, that they're honest, that they're just in their treatment, that they listen to you, that they're in control in the area of money. Apparently, most marital conflicts are caused by money more so than sex, which is kind of interesting. So you have to really understand your emotional responses and what's behind them, because it's always an issue of value judgments, always. So you have to find out what those value judgments are in order to understand the root of your passion. Saying I love you is good, but tell your partner what you love about them.
Can I jump in here with a question before Dr. Yeah. Kenish speaks? I just want to talk about what you said about subconscious emotions being based on a subconscious idea. Would that also relate to, you know, we have a lot of listeners who are women who are in their, you know, over 50 or 40s or 50s or 60s, and some of them are single, not all of them, but I hear women talk a lot about how I can't find somebody because my father left me, or I can't find somebody because I'm damaged goods, or, I'm not lovable, my husband left me, things like that. Would that be one of those constructs that kind of makes us unreasonable? Does that make sense? Do you know what I'm saying? I'm just wondering if some of the kind of emotional things that come up and get in the way of a relationship are these subconscious ideas about why we're not good enough for love.
Right. And what I, Ed, is it okay? Can I jump in?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Okay. If I'm with a client and they're saying that, you know, I just feel like I'm damaged goods, I would be cheering because they were able to expose the crappy premise, the very bad premise that is tripping them up in life, self-sabotaging them. So then they could take that, I'm damaged goods because my husband left me or because my father left me or whatever. And we would do multiple different exercises so they could see from multiple different directions that statement is not 100% true, that they're mm-hmm. damaged goods because of that. And they would put a lie to that. They would get to the point where they could hear that same phrase, I'm damaged goods, and fast forward a month or so, they would be laughing at it. They'd say, I'm not damaged goods. Mm-hmm. And it might take longer for some people, depending mm-hmm. on how deep and how pervasive the damage is. But they would be on the lookout to uproot that lousy premise that's trapping them. And not just uproot it, but they need to replace it with, I'm a decent person or I'm a reasonable person. They need to find a healthy premise to replace it with. And so it takes a lot of active work to get over the barriers that we ourselves put in place, maybe because we were harmed as children, or, you know, there are many reasons you can mm-hmm. have those very bad, feel very trapped by such thoughts. When you hear them, it's cause for celebration in my book if you're with a good therapist, because they'll help you untrap yourself.
That's great.
And, yeah.
It's a great tragedy that children with bad parents almost always blame themselves.
Mm.
Right, and
it's not their fault at all.
That's those points that you guys are making are so important, and I'm so glad that you are sharing them and articulating them, because I think really that people forget, you know, they get worn down by life and they forget that it really goes way back to something that got into, you know, their minds a long time ago.
Right, and yep. one of the good yep. questions to ask yourself, if you're feeling you're feeling in a funk and you're feeling like I'm not lovable because my father left me, or I'm damaged goods because I was abused as a child, you can ask yourself, who is in the room? what associations are you making? And you nail it down to a person. Oh, my God, my brother told me that I was an idiot my whole life. And then you can do a lot of exercises to talk back to that brother, not in real life, but, mm-hmm. you know, you can come up, you can re-empower yourself and get rid of a wrong idea that you're holding that's really holding you back. And in the context of a romantic relationship, I mean, both partners can come in with old baggage, and they can use the relationship as an opportunity to grow, not to just bring their old baggage and dump it in a new relationship,
mm-hmm.
but to grow and get rid of the old baggage and learn how to cherish one another.
Does selfish love and romance afford room for generosity?
Absolutely.
I think only generosity can come from that. But go ahead, Ed, because, you can take that one.
Because it's goodwill. You know, it's interesting. If you totally believe in altruism, everyone's your enemy, even though you don't necessarily consciously see it. Everyone's your enemy because they want your sacrifice. But under rational egoism, it makes you benevolent because you're not the slave of other people. You don't have unchosen duties. And you can, and of course, if it's your spouse, since you love your spouse selfishly, you love doing things for them. You love it because making them happy is exciting for you because it's a value to you.
Mm.
Right? I mean, there's nothing more exciting in sex other than your own pleasure than giving your partner pleasure. I mean, what a terrific experience. What a terrific experience that is.
And I would say that you're happy with your own life. You feel more settled. That doesn't mean you're still not a work in progress, but you're basically happy. And so you feel more generous. You want to open the door for a little old lady walking across the street or help her with her bags or give a stranger directions. You don't feel like you're put upon by every person you meet. And if you don't have the time for that, you don't have to sacrifice. You can just say, I'd love to give, you know, I wish I had the time to give you directions. I'm late for my doctor's appointment. Can't do that right now. I mean, you can set proper boundaries because you own your own life. There's no question about it. Whereas under altruism, you do not own your own life. The premise is that you have to serve everybody who needs you, and so you build up that resentment. And your generosity becomes that fake generosity that I mentioned earlier.
It becomes duty.
Yeah. What you said also about about how others want your sacrifice, that is really powerful when you think of it that way, that others, when you're trying to help and give, others want and expect your sacrifice. So what is the takeaway? We have just a few minutes left. What is the takeaway that you would like people to come away with once they read The Selfish Path to Romance? What would you like people to learn?
Go ahead, Ellen. Okay. I would say to really treasure your own life. It's your only life. Make it interesting for yourself, and interesting in a way that's fun. It's filled with your values, whether in friendships, you got to root out the people who are not good friends and bring better friends in. You want to have a wonderful romantic relationship, and that takes a lot of effort. You want to have hobbies you enjoy, a career you enjoy, and you want that for your partner too. And one of the key things that I would say about my relationship with my hubby is we have fun together. We laugh a lot together. We're playful. It's just, and we're not sarcastic. It's just a very upbeat, joyous, very productive environment. And it's just, we're very good listeners, and I truly feel like he's my best friend. So I would love people to take that away.
Totally agree with Ellen.
Mm. Wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah, and also just letting people know how to get our book. They can go to Amazon, and it's The Selfish Path to Romance, How to Love with Passion and Reason. They can read the first chapter for free at drkenner.com or selfishromance.com. And again, selfish means self-valuing. It doesn't mean mean and rotten. It's really taking your own life seriously and embracing it and embracing your partner, too.
Fascinating concept, fascinating book. Thank you, Dr. Ellen Kenner and Dr. Edwin A. Locke, for your contributions to our listeners tonight. Any last words for our listeners?
Yes?
I think Ellen's statement, learn to value yourself and to use your own mind.
I would say read our book.
Read the book.
Definitely read the book.
Thank you, Laurie, Sue, and Victor.
Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Victor the Voice Furman.
And I'm the Romance Reverend Laurie Sue Brockway.
And we are love.
Start again.
Who are we? Oh, and we are. And we are.
Let me redo that.
Okay. I'm Victor the Voice Furman.
And I'm the Romance Reverend Laurie Sue Brockway.
And we are love and romance radio. Thanks for joining us, everyone, and have a great night.
Thank you for having us.